Hello, friends. We're back of episode 157 of the R Weekly Highlights podcast. My name is Eric Nance, and I'm so delighted you join us from wherever you are around the world for our weekly show, where we talk about the latest highlights that you can see on this week's R Weekly issue. And as always, I am joined at the hip here. My line mate in R Weekly fun is my co-host, Mike Thomas. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Eric. It was starting to warm up here on the East Coast. Now we were getting a cold week, so it's a little frustrating, but I think that may be the theme of this week's highlights. We are venting this week in some of these highlights, and I am here for it.
Oh, as am I. And even in the pre-show, to all you can listen to, you heard about Mike here, heard about my vents on some recent rabbit holes that I went under. But yeah, we're gonna have a lot to share today because we do feel very relatable to a lot of the concepts we're about to talk about here. And how is this issue possible? Well, our curator this week was Sam Parmer, another good friend of mine from the life sciences industry. He has put together a terrific issue we're going to talk about here. And as always, he had tremendous help from our fellow RWiki team members and contributors like all of you around the world with your awesome pull requests and other suggestions. So yeah, let's get the quote-unquote venting session going. And we're going to go fast with this because Miles McBain here, Mike, has some very insightful tidbits to share, which I can tell have been gleaned from a lot of experience in data science, called the patterns and anti-patterns of data analysis reuse. So what do we have here? Why don't you set this up for us?
This is too relatable. It's a phenomenal blog post talking about, the data analyst curse and, you know, understanding that, you know, every data analysis and data scientist role that Miles has been in, and I agree with this as well. At some point in time, you're redoing variations of the same analysis. And there's two assumptions that he's making for those who would be able to relate to this blog post. The first one is that your work is written in code like R, Python, Julia, or Rust. If you're using, in his words, Power BI or, God forbid, Excel, you probably won't relate to this. And then second, you're using a technology like Quarto, R Markdown, or Shiny, such that sort of your end deliverable is generated from that code. So if this sounds like you, I am assuming that maybe you'll be able to relate to this blog post as I did. And when you're redoing, you know, that same analysis in sort of different ways, one of the first things maybe that you may start out doing as a beginning developer is copying and pasting, right, from one version of your report to the next version of your report that you need to create. And, this can be a quick solution that you have, but it may not be very extensible or maintainable, because when it comes time to update some sort of global, version of this analysis, you would have to copy and paste to each different version that you have out there. And when you're trying to fix a bug or create an enhancement, that same concept would apply, that instead of just doing that update in one specific place, you would need to copy and paste that to all of the different places because you don't have something like a template. And this is where you can start to move on towards, oh, I'm going to create a sort of a single template that is going to have parameters in it that I can set that will be able to allow me to run different versions of this analysis just based upon the different parameters that I'm passing to this. And in theory, this is great. And I think this is exactly what we all strive for. But if you have done this long enough, if you have sort of been in this world long enough, you'll start to see that as you create this parameterized global version, with each new variation of your analysis that someone's asking you to run, or each new data set that's coming in, there's going to be a new edge case that you're going to have to handle. And what that means is probably an additional parameter. And if you're like me, this can get into now you're starting to write like conditional if statements to test and see, you know, if this particular variation matches this one very, very specific edge case. And now your global template is just getting super bloated because it's trying to handle all of these different particular cases. And then at some point, someone says, hey, why don't we manage those parameters with YAML or JSON? Because for sure, right? Now we're talking about configuration. And you know, then you have a YAML or a JSON file that is supposed to manage and handle these parameters. And maybe it starts out small because there's only a few global parameters there. But again, as you introduce these different versions of this analysis, or somebody asks for this new thing, or this new data set comes in, you know, wants to look at your analysis at a different angle, you're just adding additional parameters. And now all of a sudden, your YAML file starts to get pretty long. And then maybe at some point you are having a second YAML file to manage the configuration of the first YAML file, and it's YAML all the way down, and things just start to be unwieldy, and you start to think, hey, maybe I just need to go back to cut and paste, copy and paste, and it can drive you a little insane, as I would say Miles may have gotten to in the paragraph here titled Power Overwhelming, which I think is where we start to sort of go off the rails. And I mean that in the nicest way, because this is incredibly, incredibly relatable. So then, Eric, if you want to take it away to talk about, maybe we start to move towards a package framework.
Right. And first, yes, we all can very much relate to this, because the entire spectrum of that build up to this point, I have seen with my own eyes. I have committed some of this with my own hands, if you will. And yes, sometimes the only way we learn is through painful experiences. I have had some extremely sophisticated templates in R Markdown before that had a boatload of params at the end. And sometimes I would be shared with different teams, and then they realize, oh, yep, that particular data set for that study has this type of efficacy variable, and I didn't cover it. So it just keeps adding on, until it's a point where no one knows where the central place is for that thing. And everybody copy-pasted to a different study. Some of this is ironically still happening. We are trying to put the reins on it, but yes. And when you get to this point, you think about what are ways that I can make it easier for us to maintain some kind of structure to this, still make it easy for the end user to implement in their analysis pipelines, but still be able to tap into some of the modern practices to help maintain this reusable code. And yes, spoiler alert, that does mean creating an internal package. And that may be intimidating to many people. Well, but the thing is, I would say, once you've been through these hardships, you're at a point to appreciate the upfront work to build a package, maybe more so than if we just told you this if you're brand new to data science in your particular industry or particular group. Then you're going to be ready to absorb some great resources out there already, especially in the R ecosystem, to get a package off the ground. Why should you do this, though? Is that way, instead of having these template variables and these massive templates, you can have functions with function parameters that cover much of this operation and functionality. And you don't have to have it perfect the first time. Maybe you just automate certain parts of it and you just kind of build on it over time. But having the package is going to let you opt into additional best practices to get ready for cases where maybe your package analysis functions are being used in cases you didn't anticipate. But you can build in things like automated testing. You can build in documentation on these parameters, so that you can use the wonderful tools like Use This, Test That, Dev Tools to help make this package more robust in the R ecosystem. And of course, Python fans, you have similar frameworks on that side as well. But just getting to that package step is a huge first step to start righting some of the wrongs that you may have experienced in your respective effort. Now, like anything, there's some gotchas to worry about. And another issue that I've seen firsthand, and I've seen very talented people do this firsthand, is that you started this great analysis package for your group. Maybe you called it the name of your group, who knows? And then over time, either you or others say, hey, you know what? What if this package did this new thing? What if this package did do this new thing? Suddenly, your catalog of functions going into this internal package starts to balloon up. And maybe it gets to the point where you have so many functions and some of them just don't really relate to each other. But because it felt like such hard work to get that package off the ground, everybody just wants to put it in one place. So they only have to load one package and then it's all there. But you're running into the risk, as Miles points out, of complexity overload and a lot of bloat. And especially if you need to make a change or deprecate something in that package, suddenly the whole package is being updated in ways that maybe you didn't anticipate. And so that's where going through this exercise, yes, getting to the package is a great first step, but there are a lot of diminishing returns if you decide to put everything but the kitchen sink, so to speak, in this one internal package. I've also seen this in a capability tool that we used to author for helping design clinical trials. We had a monolithic, and I do mean monolithic, application that was meant to do everything for a clinical program. And we just could not maintain it anymore. There was just so much in frameworks that honestly half of us didn't even understand, but that it was all in one monolithic code base. It just, at some point, the technical debt became too much. What did we realize and what Miles transitioned to in this piece is that instead of having this single package, try making your own internal like group of packages. He calls it the personal verse of packages. Of course, we're familiar with in the R ecosystem, the tidyverse and other groups of related packages and may make some decisions, may have common, you might say, data structures that they operate on, but they've separated their purposes, they separated their concerns into fit-for-purpose packages. This way, instead of having to update this monolithic piece with maybe that one little change, now you have a set of packages. They all contribute to a greater whole, as they say, but now you can write updates to these in fit-for-purpose fashion. So he mentions in his examples here in his current job, he's got a package called Check Yourself, definitely before you wreck yourself, I'm just saying, to help you look some quality checks, you know, for your data set. Great first step in a data analytical pipeline that makes a lot of sense. And then because Miles is a huge fan of reproducible analytical pipelines, they have a package on top of targets called TDC targets. And that's helping them build these pipelines in a unified way. It's still leveraging targets on the back end, but they're helping bootstrap that a bit easier. But see, he separated out the data checking and the analytical pipeline building into this two sets of packages. There may be others that deal with internal APIs. I'm living that world right now. Do I want to put all API calls in one like company package? Oh, heck no. We want to separate that out into its own fit for purpose thing. Because spoiler alert for me, testing APIs is a much more wieldy effort than testing normal R functions. So why do you want to boatload? Why do you want to put a monolithic package to do all of that? You want to separate that out as best you can. You're getting flexibility, but it is going to take discipline to get there. So I do think that it's not going to be easy to do this all right away. You've got to start somewhere. But honestly, the first step is recognizing when you have a problem. Because sometimes you may send these great like end products of like these templates or these monolithic templates or monolithic packages, and everybody in leadership thinks, oh, you're doing great. Yeah, this is helping the company so much. But what are you standing on? Is that foundation solid? You really got to pay attention to that, because it's one thing to get the short-term win by doing the copy-paste, you know, method, but it's going to fall down on you at some point. And honestly, nobody, like I said, nobody gets this perfect the first time. And we are all continuing learning on this. And that's where the post concludes, where you're going to have these humble beginnings, right? But then you're really honing your craft as you go along. You all don't want to see my first internal package I did at the company. It took a lot of shortcuts that I'm not proud of. But getting there was a huge first step for me. And then as I learned from the community, as I learned from my teammates, learning from, you know, I'm very privileged to learn from Will Landau basically every time I talk to him about something new. So all these things just build upon it. You're going to get even more comfortable with this. And obviously time is another factor. Time is not infinite. We have to prioritize this. But honestly, I'm of the belief if you take the time up front to set this up the right way, even if you don't quite know how you're going to get to that end goal yet, but you know that there are some best practices you want to start with, that is going to be a huge help to minimize the technical debt that Miles is definitely outlining here if you go with that quote-unquote easy approach to do this at first. So all in all, I think the biggest piece of advice is when you see you're doing your copy-pasting a bit too much, stop, pause, try to think about what are ways that we can make this reusable and, more importantly, maintainable in your team. I really resonated with many things in this, and credit to Miles for putting this in such a, you know, comprehensive yet, you know, very much an evolutionary type story of what data analysis pipelines are all about. And definitely start, like I said, start small, but once you start small and do fit for purpose, you know, I think you're going to be on the right foot. So definitely spoken to for experience, I can tell with his insights here. So yeah, really excellent post. And I think Mike, you and I have been through this quite a few times in our internal adventures, right?
No, it's a little too relatable. And there's, you know, there's a lot of things to try to balance here, right? As you move from a script to function to a package and then back and forth, sort of depending on your use case. If I may just read a very small excerpt that I think is worth reading. You know, he talks about, you know, creating a massive function that gets written with maybe a dozen arguments, you know, that has hundreds of lines of code. That's not really much different than just a wrapper around some sort of data analysis script that you would have. And it's great that you're using functions, but you're actually like attempting to template your entire solution using the function's arguments. And he has a little footnote in here that says, if a function starts taking YAML configuration files as arguments, you are on borrowed time. And the last paragraph I want to read, this is, if Shakespeare was a data scientist, he would have written this. Such a function is pretty much untestable due to the combinatoric explosion of possible sets of inputs, and you can bet that the internals are not written in high-level domain-specific code. When I look at that function signature, I hear the screams of matrices being ground to a fine powder of bits through the conical burrs of nested for loops and labored index arithmetic. I mean, it's incredible. It's poetic.
And it's most definitely real, right? Yep. I have seen this. The approach I've seen is that, hey, you know what? This package, we're just going to let the user load a custom CSV with all the params inside. Like, oh my gosh, no, please stop the pain.
Yes.
But it is the crutch that people will fall back on is, you know what? It's a lot of work to put all those as function parameters. And I don't want to test that. Just burn it config. It's all about the user configs. No, it's not about the user configs. What it's about is building an actual package that has actual documentation and actual testing. Yes, I am firm on that, because when you don't do that, you may not pay for it right away, but somebody's going to pay for it. And it'll most likely be your end users. And that's about the worst result of all.
I agree. No, we have a client who leverages a third-party API that, in order to send your params to that API, you send your data and then you send this wild like ASCII file, a text file that just, you know, has no delimitation or whatever you want to call it, and you just have to like add an N or a Y depending on which things you want to receive back from the API, and then you have to zip it all up and send a zip file. It's pretty wild. But let's vent about something else, Eric.
Yep. Yeah, I think we need to now think about, you know what? We've thrown a lot of knowledge your way, and we acknowledge that it's not always easy for you to know everything at once, right? We're all continuing learning, and of course, if we don't have the answer to a question, we're probably going to ask for help in certain ways, especially online, right? I mean, how many times have I Googled for how to do something esoteric with like an R to call this, you know, API parameter or whatnot, or do this new statistical function that I'm just not as familiar with. So like anybody else, Mike, I know you and I have searched, you know, the internet's webs quite a bit for a certain help here and there. And, you know, with the advent of R over the years, you're starting to see a lot more results that are tailored to R itself. Certainly posts on Stack Overflow and things like that. And then you'll start to see in these search results, you know, some things that look interesting, but don't quite look right. And what is this trend we're talking about here? Well, our next highlight is coming from Matt Dre, another previous contributor to R Weekly. He's noticed this trend too, and we'll just kind of take this bit for bit, because I think those of you that have used R for a bit and have been searching for various help or tutorials on there have probably seen this, because you will often see these websites that are now coming up higher in the rankings that look almost too good to be true, but they kind of are too good to be true, because these are sites that are coming up that have clearly, you can kind of tell whether it's said explicitly or kind of implicitly, they're being written by some kind of bot, maybe some kind of AI framework. We don't want to send traffic there, so like he, Matt, or I are not going to tell you the names of these sites, but they are very easy to kind of hook you in to acting like these are authenticated, you know, very authoritative sources, I should say. And sometimes you'll see that the same overall site is producing like thousands of these guides for each package individually. But the guides are not coming from the package authors. They're not coming from people in the community that we've, you know, seen or like an authentic blog post. They're these like AI generated, you know, narratives that somehow have some great search engine optimization built in so that they're showing near at the top of your search results. But clearly they're not playing the right way here. And I think it kind of stinks. So I think that's pretty clear to me why this is a bad thing to see happen, but it's also reality that we all need to deal with. It's not like a quite one-to-one example here, but of course, most of us have cell phones and we get these robocalls left and right on our cell phones. And we know they're bogus, even though they try to act like they're coming from our area code, right? But these are like some real bogus results that are trying to show, quote unquote, a guide to use a certain package. It's not. But yeah, Matt continues in his post about just why, in his opinion, this is a bad thing that this keeps happening. Mike, why don't you take us through why? What are some of the downsides of what we're seeing here?
Yeah, you know, I think what's going to happen here for the most part is that some of these summarizations that take place when it's a bot or, you know, AI, whatever that means, is sort of summarizing and trying to scrape the web and put together these R, you know, help sites. You know, I think what's going to happen here is just a lot of the specificity is going to get washed out. And not only is the content terrible because it's not written by a human for humans, but the ethics are pretty bad as well. They're really just trying to either make money off of you somehow, you know, redirect you to some affiliate site, you know, and you also have to remember that in a way, they're sort of stealing their content. You know, a lot of the content on the web that people are putting out there in terms of, you know, Stack Overflow help and, you know, stuff that's actually authored by someone. And you know, we went down the rabbit hole a little bit when we started talking about Copilot. Is a lot of this content does not necessarily, you know, have like a Creative Commons license behind it that says, hey, you know, go for it and scrape this and use it however you want. You know, it's probably scraping stuff that the author may have not given them consent to scrape. So that's crappy. The fact that it's moving up in terms of SEO, because, you know, I guess that's probably something that AI is fairly good at as well, right? To try to make the site look like a site that gets a lot of clicks. That's, I guess, the name of the game these days, unfortunately. And I'm seeing it myself. You know, I'm having a harder time getting to Stack Overflow links, mm-hmm. which have traditionally been really the thing that has helped me the most, has helped get me to my answer the quickest. And usually maybe I have to sort through two or three or four different Stack Overflow links to find my exact solution. But in the past, that would come up, those links would come up very, very high, you know, if not the first result, you know, the second result. And now they're much sparser, unfortunately. And I am having to sort, like Matt, through a lot of this crap, unfortunately, to try to get to the good stuff. So it stinks, you know. And Matt is taking sort of a pessimistic view here, which maybe I share. I don't know. I hadn't put too much thought into this until Matt's blog post. But we don't see really an avenue where this gets better as opposed to gets worse. I don't know, Eric.
Yeah, I think it's a reality. Like I said, even my robocall example, it's like no matter how many you block, there's always others going to keep coming. And I think there's going to be these sites that crop up with now AI and automation becoming so much easier for the masses, or in the case of some of these, you know, unethical corporations or whoever's behind some of these, to just launch all these automated processes on some server somewhere and do the SEO gaming up of search results. I think the biggest thing we can recommend is to never to have like a careful eye as you're searching these results. And I think over time you'll see these patterns, such as Matt has been talking about here in this post. But I'm going to say the best places to draw upon for, you know, help for, say, a package itself is hopefully the package documentation itself. Most of them now have package down sites. They usually have a GitHub repository or GitHub-like repository. And, you know, seeing what issues have been talked about for that particular package on their issue board. Like, that's a great way to learn, even just by scraping through that. And also leveraging community-based built resources that you know are being built by humans. And guess what? Another spoiler alert. Our weekly is built by humans, right? We are linking to content that has been created by package authors, by data scientists, by others in the field that are authentic. And that's why we have a curator to always sift through. We get noise too, just as much as anyone else, but we wipe the heck out of those. We make sure those don't get into our issue. Unfortunately for search engines, we don't have that control, right? They're just always going to kind of pop up from time to time. I think if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, so to speak. So definitely have a careful eye to that, especially those, as Matt points out, will have some random affiliate link somewhere, maybe the footer of the site or it's a sidebar or whatnot. No, I don't see that for authentic R-based content or data science content in my days. So I think it's more about with experience, you're going to be able to see this more quickly. I think what Matt does here is at least bringing awareness to the issue that this is real. It's probably not slowing down, and to just making sure that you are, you know, looking at the authentic community-based, or in some cases, the developer-authored resources to really get you in the right direction for your particular issue. But Matt, I see at the end of the post, yeah, you also grew up in the times I grew up with. Good old floppy disk, right? We didn't have fancy AI bots generating these queries. We had to make sure that 5.25 floppy disk somehow worked in our IBM, you know, PCs or Apple IIgs. Shout out to all those that use vintage Apple computers. So it's a different time now. And that, I think with that just comes some new skills that we have to learn about finding the best from the noise, as they say.
Yep. No, I remember you wanted to know something. You looked it up in an encyclopedia. So I very much...
At the library, no less.
Yeah, at the library, no less. I think we had an encyclopedia on a CD-ROM at home or something like that when I was growing up.
That's right.
Yeah, no, times have certainly changed. And I think, you know, unfortunately, that means navigating the internet and search results, you know, requires new skills to be able to do so. But it's unfortunate that some of these sites out there exist, because it sort of feels like cheating.
Now, with that said, of course, what are ways that you can kind of get your journey of data science started off right, especially if you're new and you want to turn to maybe a human-generated resource to help you? Well, one thing that has helped me over the years, and I think many others would agree, is the concept of having that handy cheat sheet next to you, so that if you're looking up stuff all the time but you just want a quick reminder of how something works, you know, cheat sheets are a great way to have at your desk or at your virtual wallpaper or whatever have you, to kind of get those concepts reinforced from time to time. And our last highlight is actually a new cheat sheet in the R community, authored by Jacob Scott, who is a data scientist based in the UK. And Jacob has put together this best practice for R cheat sheet. And he is very much upfront in his repository that this is highly opinionated in some of his preferred workflows. But I think there are some concepts here that we can very much relate to, especially in the context of if you are following the advice of what Miles authored in our first highlight, some ways you can get started pretty quickly. One thing that, whether you're running RStudio proper or not, but having some kind of project structure is, it's one of those things that you take for granted, but boy, oh boy, I have seen countless times people like throw all their R scripts in one directory that have no real relation to each other. Just throw it all in there, right? Have you ever done that, Mike?
I've seen it. Maybe I did it when I was starting out, potentially, when I didn't necessarily know best practices around, you know, what an R project even was. You know, like I said, when I was taught R in undergrad, we were only taught R Markdown. I didn't even know what an R script was. I only knew the existence of .rmd files. So there's a possibility that at some point in my journey, which I don't want to maybe dive back into, that I would have been guilty of that. But I am very happy to have found and understood our projects.
Yes. And yeah, certainly the examples he's talking about here, they are specific to RStudio, but you can do this in any other typical IDE as well. I mean, VS Code has workspaces you can utilize. And of course, you know, there are loads of extensions and the classical frameworks that people turn into IDEs like Vim or Emacs to do similar things too. The idea is just logical grouping of your code. And he's got a nice little snippet here in the cheat sheet about what his project structure looks like. It's got, you know, subfolders for the scripts itself. It's got, you know, potential database query, SQL scripts, you know, all, and of course he's using RM too. That's an even another best practice that I think goes, it needs to be reinforced, is that these projects can have wildly different dependency requirements. And in the R side of things, having RM is a real bulletproof way, give or take a few gotchas here and there, of making sure that you can reproduce that R-based execution environment, you know, within reason, from project to project, and be able to have that finer-tuned control for your dependencies. And then also there's some great sections in here about how to create a rep rex, which again, we were talking about getting help, right? Finding ways to effectively communicate and effectively search. Well, if you know that you're having an issue with a said package or another, you know, utility, the best way to get help from the community, whether it's in Stack Overflow or say Posit community or whatnot, is having a rep rex so that it shows in a very concise manner what exact error you're getting and let others reproduce that error. Reprex is not, this is not the first time we mentioned Reprex on this Highlights podcast over the years. So I think having that skill set is a great way to put yourself in best position to not only ask for help, but then to receive it as well. And then there are also some great sections here about how do you connect the databases. And I've used the DBI package quite a bit. He's got a little snippet about connecting to a database with that as well. And then others such as styling. Again, there can be different takes on how you style your code. What Jacob recommends here, I believe, is a variation of the Tidyverse style guide with certain pieces. But again, I think the key, as we mentioned maybe a few weeks ago, is just consistency. Once you have consistent styling, no matter if you use the Tidyverse framework or, let's say, Google's framework or any your own company's framework, having consistency is going to help you as well as your future self and collaborators on those projects. And then it concludes with some links to learning more about the R community and building R for, you know, R projects, such as R for data science, building packages of R packages, and really getting into the nuts and bolts of R with Advanced R. And yes, for the Shiny fans out there, a link to Mastering Shiny as well. Highly recommended. But I think it's a great way to get started. I think for those new to the R framework, this is one of those great examples to get you started off the right way. And it's going to whet your appetite, so to speak, to dive into some of these concepts in more detail. So really nice job here, Jacob. And I think it belongs in many collections of cheat sheets out there.
Yeah, this is absolutely beautiful design-wise, the way that he drew this up. It says that he originally created a similar version of this cheat sheet specifically for use in the UK Department of Education, but he's created this more generalized version, I think, for everybody else, which is fantastic. And it sort of makes me think about, perhaps, you know, you may want to create a cheat sheet similar to this within your own organization that, you know, mentions and outlines some of the specific best practices that you want to follow and employ within your own organization. So if you're looking for inspiration to do something like that, this would be a great place to start.
Yeah, and he does have link in the GitHub repo to additional cheat sheets that are available on Posit's site. You know, we see many contribute to that, both from Posit and outside of Posit too. That style is very reminiscent of that. So I think it's interesting. Yeah, interesting way to get started the right way. And I'm always all for, again, human generated R resources out there. No bot made that resource. I can pretty much tell that one.
That's right.
Yep. And like I said, what else do bots not create? Well, it's the R Weekly issue itself. We've got a curator helping with that every single week. And again, Sam did a tremendous job with this issue. And we'll take a couple minutes to talk about our additional finds that we found in this issue. For me, I'm still very much in my learning journey of, you know, APIs with R, but also developing web-based resources with R, and pushing like Shiny to new directions, and pushing even the Quartal sites I create to new directions. And friend of the show, Albert Rapp, has another terrific blog post here in his Web Dev for R section. One area that I simply have to always keep looking up every time, it's not muscle memory yet, but getting a handle on selecting certain elements in your CSS style sheets. And he's got both a video and an accompanying blog post to talk about how you can select particular tags of a certain type with both the source code and solution right there in the post itself. Selecting elements by class. Lots of things that, unless you really practice with it, especially if you're new to web dev, it's going to seem pretty foreign to you. But he brings it home with how he used these techniques to modify some of the styling behind a GT table that he was creating. So you can give it a little extra personality, a little extra style along the way. So if you're in the world of CSS style and you're just not sure where to go to get that particular nagging element that you want to make like a bold font or make a red color background, this is a great post to let you dive into just what kind of detective skills you might need to get to that said element and make it look the way you want it to. But Mike, what did you find?
Oh, that's a great find, Eric. And the Shiny developer in me and the web scraper in me is very interested in checking that one out to dive down and figure out very specific CSS and style elements on a web page. That's awesome. I found, very interestingly, a phenomenal article in Nature by Jeffrey M. Perkle called No Installation Required, how WebAssembly is changing scientific computing. I think we teased this a little bit last week, but it's a fantastic walkthrough about WebAssembly. It starts off with some quotes from George Stagg at Posit, who has done so much work on the WebR package to allow us to write R code that is compatible with the WebAssembly framework and essentially have the work run in the user's browser and no server required, which obviously is pretty game-changing, something we've talked about many times here, and it's really the theme of this blog post. And it's a really interesting article because there's little anecdotes from many people with many different perspectives on this topic. One of those people being my co-host, statistician Eric Nance.
And
you have an awesome quote here that you believe WebAssembly will minimize, from the reviewer's perspective, many of the steps that they had to take to get an application running on their own machine in the context of clinical trials. I totally agree. I really enjoyed reading this article, and it's very exciting, again, for me to see this topic being picked up in something like Nature. It's super exciting because it means that it's gaining steam out there.
Yeah, I'm as excited as anybody right now in this space, and the fact that we're being recognized in places I never even dreamed of as we're kind of pushing the envelope here. I think it's just another piece where this has the chance to transform so many things, and not only my industry but many other places as well. And we're just at the tip of the iceberg. There's still a lot of growth here, but I sense that, you know, we're gonna be talking about this for years to come as one of these next big evolutions in technology at the intersection of data science. We're on the way, Mike. We're on the way. Yep. And one other thing I want to leave off with, and a good friend of the show as well, John Harmon, he's been, you know, sending out some posts on his Mastodon account and LinkedIn about a recent unfortunate event with the R for Data Science community, and that their particular provider that they've been using for assembling funds to keep the project going has unfortunately changed direction. And now they're kind of looking at other ways to receive, you know, robust funding through a robust infrastructure. So I will just mention, if you're in this space, maybe be able to help John out with some advice on where to go for additional funding opportunities for R for Data Science and platforms that they can leverage. Certainly get in touch with John personally. I'm sure he would love to hear, you know, some other advice that people have along the way. So again, really hoping to see the R for Data Science group keep going. But I know it's going to be, it's always tough when you rely on a platform to help centralize some of this, and then they pull the rug from under you. So let's hope for the best, John. And certainly if we find any, you know, resources, we'll pass them along your way.
Yes. No, please help out, John, if you have the means to be able to do so, because this R4DS community is fantastic. I think that it's helping a lot of people get up to speed with R and get introduced with R. It's helping people like me with very niche questions, and just an incredible community of folks who are willing to help one another and to listen and to try to encourage each other in our programming journeys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I was reading some of his latest posts here as of 4 days ago. They did get some additional funding before that host kind of pulled the rug from under them, but that's not going to last forever. So again, I'll put a link in the show notes to where you can contact John and contact the project. So again, we really hope for the best here. And talking about finding great resources for help, I mean, we've said this many times, the R for Data Science community has so many helpful participants at all skill levels. It is a wonderful resource out there. They have book clubs, they have groups dedicated to different packages or different frameworks. It is all there for the taking. And really, some of the best support you can do is even just helping out with that community on top of financial donations. So I'm sure he would welcome that as well. And speaking of welcoming, we welcome your feedback too, this humble little endeavor we call a podcast here. And what are ways that you can help us out? Well, first, the RWiki project itself would love to get your new package idea or new package resource. If you have a blog post, a tutorial, or announcement you want to share, we're just a pull request away. It's all marked down all the time. Where you can do that is linked right in the top right corner of ourweekly.org. The link to this current issue's draft, our upcoming issue draft, I should say. And then you can just send your pull request there, and our curator of the week will be glad to merge that in for you. And as well, we love to hear from you in the community. There are many ways to do that. We have a little contact page in this episode's show notes that you can send us direct feedback with. You can also have a new modern podcast app like Podverse, Fountain, Cast-O-Matic, CurioCaster. I could go on and on. They have a little boost functionality. You can send a fun little message along the way. And a quick congrats to my friends at Jupiter Broadcasting, because they used this modern infrastructure from the Fountain app to do live podcast episodes on the ground at the recent Scale and Nix conferences in California. It was a good time to be had, so you might want to search them out. There was some amazing content there. And yeah, the Nix stuff was quite entertaining, so I'm thinking of Bruno right away when I listen to this, and I may have to dust off the Nix stuff now. And again, I'm even more inspired than I was last week.
I'm sure his ears are ringing.
Yes, I'll have to link that in the show notes, Bruno. I think you'll find it very interesting. But as well as what's awful interesting is hearing from you, as I said. You can also get in touch with us on social media. I am on Mastodon mostly these days with @ourpodcast at podcastindex.social. I am also sporadically on the Weapon X thing at the Rcast, and as well on LinkedIn as well. You can just search for my name and you'll see all my show announcements and other fun announcements there. And Mike, where can the listeners find you?
Yeah, probably best on LinkedIn. If you search Ketch Brook Analytics, KETCHBROOK, you can find out what I'm up to. Or on Mastodon at Mike_Thomas@Fastodon.org.
Awesome stuff. And certainly, yeah, we love hearing from you, as I said. And our weekly train keeps on going. And hopefully we keep going again for the foreseeable future. But I can guarantee you, there will be no robotic voices on this podcast. You can be sure we are the authentic Eric and Mike, whether you like it or not.
That's right.
Yep. So we will close up shop here. And thanks again for joining us from wherever you are. And definitely helps if you want to spread the word for others in your organizations learning data science. You know, spreading word about the podcast is probably some of the best support we can get. So we greatly appreciate that. So we will close up shop here, and we will be back with another episode of our weekly highlights next week.